Good morning, and welcome to the Barbara Jordan Conference Center for this session. I'm Diane Rowland, the Executive Vice President of the Kaiser Family Foundation, and we're glad to have you here on this dreary morning to talk about a topic which I wish I could say was going to be uplifting and leave you in a much happier mood, but I think it's an issue that instead is going to help us better understand the reality of what this recession has meant to so many Americans and the struggles that they continue to have, as well as the struggles those in our healthcare system are facing as they try to deal with this very deep recession that we're now experiencing. And I think it's particularly important to have this session today as the health reform debate seems to dominate all news and all issues of healthcare these days, when in fact the healthcare reforms that we're talking about, if and when enacted, will take place years from now as they are phased in, while today there are millions of people who are out there trying to maintain coverage and deal with severe family budget issues as we weather this recession. And I think that one of the goals that we have as the Kaiser Family Foundation is to continue to really put the voice and the faces of the people who are affected by these issues out before you and out before the policymakers so that we can hopefully craft better solutions to the daily struggles that they're facing. This program today continues the work that we've done to try and talk to people about their experiences in the economic downturn, to meet with some of their providers of care, and to try and shine a light on what is going on. And today, of course, is the day before the next round of unemployment statistics come out tomorrow, when we can expect to see a continued struggle for families to maintain their employment and then to find health insurance coverage for themselves and their families in the absence of job-based coverage. This event today will be webcast and available at the end of the day on the Kaiser Family Foundation website, kff.org. You used to go to Kaiser Network to try and find these things, but they're going to be available now through kff.org, the sponsor of today's briefing. And I think we have a very ambitious plan for you, but also some terrific speakers and a lot of good insights that we hope will come out about the struggles that are going on and some of the policy options and the effect of the stimulus bill on helping to maintain coverage for some of our most vulnerable populations. We're going to start today's session by asking Robin Rudowitz, the principal policy analyst with the Kaiser Family Foundation's Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, to really go through some of our key findings on the rising health pressures, both from the focus groups we've done around the country, as well as from discussions we've had with the Medicaid directors. And then we're going to turn to a video, which will bring some of the voices and the faces of the people that we've interviewed onto our screen so that you can see more directly what their experiences are. And then following that, want to really have an in-depth discussion from multiple perspectives about what's going on with the economic downturn and especially its impact on low-income families. We'll turn first to Barbara Edinburgh, the Assistant Director of the Bridgeport Child Advocacy Coalition in Bridgeport, Connecticut, to provide some of the perspective from those on the ground trying to connect people with their health insurance coverage. Then we're going to turn to a distinguished member of our Medicaid Commission, Art Kellerman, who's a physician and professor of emergency medicine at Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta and co-chair of the Institute of Medicine's study of the uninsured and the consequences of lack of coverage, to provide some perspective from the provider on the ground trying to deal with these issues at Grady and other public hospitals and safety net facilities around the country. Finally, Joan Henneberry, who's the Executive Director of the Colorado Department of Healthcare Policy and Financing, is going to share with us the views of those trying to run the public programs that try and meet these needs in these economic times that are so difficult.
and then the new director of the Center for Medicaid and State Operations at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, our friend and colleague Cindy Mann, will give us some insight from her new role as the head of the Medicaid program and state operations on the issues facing the Medicaid program from both the federal perspective and certainly from everything she's hearing from the field. So I think it promises to be not necessarily the most uplifting discussion you will have, but certainly one that is very informative about the challenges and issues that are being faced by families today as we deal with this recession. So we'll start with Robin Rudowitz, who will give you all the good news. And in doing that, we would like to thank both Robin and Julia Paradise, who's not here today, but who helped contribute with Barbara Lyons to our report, and to the Michael Perry team of Julia Cummings and Meredith Lewis from Lake Research Partners, and especially their help in putting together the focus groups that led to our video that we'd like to thank Jackie Judd and her team for putting together, and Donna Cohen-Ross at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities is always invaluable in helping us to find the families and the faces that go along with this video, as well as with our focus group report. And our work with the Medicaid directors lets us have a real insight into what goes on in the states. And we thank Vern Smith and his HMA colleagues for their continuing work with us on tracking what's going on, but especially to NASMED and the Medicaid directors themselves for their willing participation in helping us to understand the forces at the state level as well. So with that, we will now turn to Robin to give you some of our key findings.
Good morning, and thank you all for coming today for this very important discussion about the ripple effects of the recession, rising unemployment, and the loss of health coverage on families, communities, states, and providers. I am going to provide a little bit of background and context, and then, as Diane said, go into the key findings from the major reports that we're releasing today. If we look back to data from 2007, we know that about two-thirds of the non-elderly Americans had private coverage, mostly through their own or their family's employer. Another 16% had public coverage, mostly through Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program, and 45 million people were left uninsured. Most of the uninsured are adults, and most of them have income at about twice or less than twice the poverty level, or about $44,000 for a family of four. Since the end of 2007, which really marked the start of the recession, the national unemployment rate has climbed from 4.9% to 9.5% in June. And as Diane said, we are expecting new unemployment figures out tomorrow. Over this period, 6.5 million people have lost their jobs, and the unemployment rate, or the unemployment figure, is now at 14.7 million people. We know these numbers are, in fact, low, given that millions of Americans have accepted work or part-time work, and many are not even counted in these figures because they have given up on looking for work. While nearly all states have been really affected by the recession, the impact really does vary across states. In June, 22 states had unemployment rates that were at or above 9%. Higher unemployment rates are linked to major declines in personal income, corporate, and sales tax revenues for the states. For the first quarter of 2009, states experienced a decrease in overall state tax revenue of 11.8% from the same period in the last year. This is the largest decline on record, and early figures for the second quarter show a continued worsening in the fiscal situation for states. States are really facing dire budget circumstances, and they could face shortfalls of over $160 billion for 2010 and in excess of $350 billion through 2011. Loss in revenue make it difficult for states to pay their share of increasing Medicaid costs related to increases in enrollment and support care for the uninsured. We estimate that job losses since the end of 2007 have led to more than 11 million individuals who have lost coverage through the workplace. These declines in employer coverage have been related to expected increases of about 4.5 million in Medicaid and CHIP enrollment and an expected nearly 5 million more people who are without insurance. Most of the increase in enrollment for public health programs is for children. Most states cover children at or above 2 times the poverty level, so Medicaid and CHIP are an effective safety net for children who would otherwise be uninsured when they lose their private coverage. However, Medicaid eligibility levels for parents is much more limited. 29 states cover parents with incomes below half of the poverty level, and the median eligibility level for parents is just 41% of poverty, or about $7,500 for a family of three. Medicaid is generally not available for non-disabled adults without dependent children, so these childless adults really have virtually no options for affordable coverage. In an effort to boost an ailing economy, Congress enacted and the President signed the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, or ARRA, in February. One of the most significant pieces of ARRA was $87 billion related to a temporary increase in the federal share of Medicaid costs from October 2008 through the end of December 2010. Similar to relief that was provided in 2003 during the last economic downturn, these funds are really designed to help support state Medicaid programs at a time when states are least able to afford their share. The relief includes a base increase in state matching rates for Medicaid, as well as additional funds targeted to states who are experiencing extraordinarily high increases in unemployment. To be eligible for the funds, states could not restrict their eligibility levels or their enrollment procedures. In addition, the ARRA included a 65% subsidy for individuals terminated from their jobs between September 2008 and December 2009 to help them pay and continue their employer-based coverage through COBRA. However, even with the subsidy, COBRA is still expensive and many are not eligible for that program. One of the benefits of the Medicaid relief that was part of ARRA was that it reached the states quickly. According to the GAO, 90% of the ARRA funds outlaid by mid-June that were directed for states and localities were related to the Medicaid relief funds. With that in the way of background, I want to turn to some of the findings from our reports that we're releasing today. First, we have some insights from discussions with the leading Medicaid directors that took place in June. It will come as absolutely no surprise that the recession is having a major effect on Medicaid programs. Enrollment and spending trends are up and well above original projections, which is contributing to severe state budget pressures. In fact, one director noted that enrollment in the previous 3 months had exceeded enrollment growth over the entire last year. The ARRA funds from Medicaid have been critical for states in helping them to address budget shortfalls and also to avoid or soften any Medicaid cuts that otherwise would have occurred, and also to help preserve eligibility. However, even with the ARRA funds, states are still struggling, and there's an intense focus on maintaining programs and controlling costs. However, since states enacted so many cost containment measures during the last economic recession or downturn, it's been difficult to find reasonable options to help address costs, and major cuts are on the table, including cuts to provider rates and to benefits. While most states are still struggling, some states are working hard to maintain the coverage that they have and also to advance coverage initiatives. For an update on the impact of the recession and how that's affecting communities, we conducted focus groups and spoke to community organizations, providers, and employers in 4 cities across the country in California, Florida, New York, and Wisconsin. We found that the financial crisis for families is severe and markedly worse than when we spoke to families in November and December of last year. There are no jobs, homes are in or at risk of being foreclosed, individuals have depleted all savings that they have, they're incurring medical debt, and they're having significant difficulty navigating systems, assistance programs that they may be eligible for. Employers are also struggling, and they're facing difficulty cutting costs and decisions and trade-offs between having to do layoffs and also cut back on healthcare coverage. The recession has really highlighted these wide gaps in our healthcare system, where children are often eligible for Medicaid and CHIP, and we found that parents are extremely grateful for this coverage, but adults are generally not eligible for coverage, and COBRA, even with the subsidy or non-group coverage, are out of reach. Underinsured and uninsured people are delaying and foregoing important health care, ranging from filling prescriptions for serious conditions like hypertension and seizures, delaying or not going to follow-up care related to cancer screenings, and really putting off primary and preventive care as well as dental care. The safety net has been critical, but really cannot fill all the gaps in the health coverage system. There are long waits in the emergency room and very long waits to get appointments in the clinics. There aren't enough doctors, and there are shrinking resources to support the safety net. These strains will be exacerbated as the number of uninsured increase and as we're predicting an aggressive return of the swine flu in the fall. So to sum up, looking forward for states that we know that even when and if the economy starts to recover, unemployment and Medicaid will really lag behind and continue to rise. So budget pressures at the state level are likely to continue to persist. Many states are very concerned about the end of the ARRA funds in the beginning of 2011 because they really don't expect their economies to be fully recovered by that time. And as policymakers in Washington debate federal health reform, states see this as critical, but also have concerns about new fiscal responsibilities as well as administrative and provider capacity related to implementing potential new reforms related to expansions of Medicaid. For individuals, it seems clear that more and better efforts would help connect families to existing assistance programs. It's also clear, as Diane said, that even if health reform does pass, these individuals need immediate assistance and access to health care and coverage right now. But in the near term, if enacted, health reform could promise new options for affordable health care for these struggling families. And with that, I will turn it over to the video.
So the report that Robin has reviewed is in your packets, Rising Health Pressures in an Economic Recession, a 360 look at four communities, and one of those communities, Barbara Edinburg, is here to talk about as well. But we wanted to bring the people from our focus groups to you, so now we're going to turn to the video that we have, On the Edge, Healthcare in the Recession. It is going to be available through the webcast so that you can view it on our kff.org website. But also, we do have some copies of the DVD for anyone who would like to take one home after you see the video. So with that, let's play the video.
These are the faces of the recession: a small business owner, a community agency director, an unemployed husband and father, a primary care physician. The recession, especially its impact on health coverage, touches them all in some way. When new construction came to a grinding halt in Florida, Fred Walker's glass and window business in St. Petersburg did too. Sales plunged more than 50%. A staff of 11 shrunk to 6.
Everybody was busy. We had lots of guys working here, and everyone was doing well. We had all the overtime we wanted. It was an amazing crash.
That crash forced him to dip into his savings 3 times to make payroll, and the health insurance coverage he has long been committed to offering his employees became a crushing burden.
I just push on ahead and do what I know how to do.
Walker, who pays half of his workers' premiums, had already switched to a less expensive plan with a $6,000 deductible. But in this recession, that still wasn't enough to help make ends meet.
As I saw the cutbacks coming, that was one of the things that had to go.
So he was came to me and said that he was considering having to do that. And I told him, well, I've got this lump in my chest that I'd like to go get that checked before you do that, just in case.
The lump was breast cancer. on her hourly wages, cancer, and the potential loss of health insurance threatened to wreck Mindy Reed physically and financially. What rescued her was Walker's decision to not drop the coverage for now.
I depend on these people and they depend on me, so I wouldn't do that. I may not be able to continue to do it, but I'm hoping to get at least Mindy through her treatment.
Reed had surgery and says she returned to work sooner than she probably should have and without chemotherapy so she wouldn't lose income.
It just breaks my heart that, you know, something that's so totally out of my control is going to be what takes me down financially. You know, I said I can survive it physically, but I don't know about financially.
The recession has rolled hard and fast through Long Island in New York, where the cost of living is high. Home foreclosures are more frequent here than elsewhere in the region. Unemployment has skyrocketed.
There is the overall challenge that there are not enough resources to cover the gaps in services that folks here on Long Island need.
The agency Gwen O'Shea runs links residents to social services, such as health care. It's an agency swamped with requests, just as its funding has been reduced.
There are a lot more folks that come through our door on a daily basis. There are a lot more folks that call us on a daily basis, and there is an increase across the board.
O'Shea says children of families in need are most likely to get health care because of New York State's Medicaid and children's health insurance programs. Adults, however, don't usually qualify. O.C. Pompey earned $75,000 a year as a manager for Verizon until he was laid off last winter. Unable to find a new job, he's living on unemployment benefits that amount to a quarter of his previous earnings.
I could take care of myself, I could take care of my family, and since I lost my job, you know, all those things that I took for granted, you know, I have to look at.
Pompey lost his health insurance when he lost his job. He and his wife considered paying the full cost of health insurance through COBRA, but even with a federal subsidy, COBRA would have eaten up almost all of his unemployment benefits.
We were debating for a while, well, if we both can't afford it, you know, which one of us, you know, maybe could use it, you know, more. And, you know, as a husband, you know, you don't want to have to make that choice. So we decided that, you know, we couldn't afford the COBRA. And if we couldn't, you know, both afford it, we'd both, you know, we'd do without.
Like Pompey, the recession has led to a frightening and unfamiliar world for Laurie Layton. After losing her job in the mortgage industry, her home in Virginia to foreclosure, her health insurance, she moved in with family on Long Island. At a low point, she turned to a food bank for help.
I had no idea how to navigate the system. It was totally a new experience for me.
Layton recently found a job, but it has no benefits and the pay is so minimal she can't afford health insurance or a visit to the doctor who treated her for thyroid cancer.
I have to go every year to see my doctor, and I have not been there now in a year and a half. I was due to go in December for my 5-year checkup and could not afford to go. It scares me to death every day.
While there is a safety net, it's been stretched beyond capacity in this recession. Beloit, Wisconsin has been hammered by the fallout in the auto industry, with unemployment this summer topping 18%.
When Kathy gets back.
Richard Gruber is with Mercy Health System, which has 65 medical facilities in southern Wisconsin and northern Illinois. Clinics and emergency rooms here are facing unprecedented demands.
We've seen a dramatic increase in the amount of charity care that we provide. We've seen a dramatic increase in the amount of Medicaid services that we provide, both inpatient and outpatient.
Uncompensated care at Mercy is climbing steadily. Gruber expects it to reach $50 million next year, a 30% increase over last year.
How are you today?
Good.
Yeah?
The Beloit Area Community Health Center has tried to accommodate a community on the ropes by lowering the minimum payment from $20 to $10 and adding a doctor who sees walk-in patients a few days a week.
Okay.
Dr. Ildi Martonfi says wait times for regular appointments have grown to a month, and when she does see patients, she sees evidence that more are delaying care and ignoring significant problems.
They come in saying, well, you know, gosh, doc, you know, I'm here for, you know, I twisted my ankle. But, you know, yeah, now that you mention it when you're asking me how I'm doing, you know, I have this chest pain now and then. And you delve into it more. This is chest pain that, you know, could be concerning for something wrong with their heart.
Nicole, do you know if
they don't want to rack up a big bill that they won't be able to pay for?
The fallout from this recession clearly runs deep and wide across the country. Americans everywhere are living the problems Congress is debating about health care reform. Health care coverage is eroding. Safety net providers are stretched thin. Money is so tight, some Americans are risking their health by forgoing care. And no one knows where or when this will end.
I think that video clearly demonstrates the hard realities that many families are facing today, and I think that our panel is going to help you to understand even better some of those realities on the ground. I'm going to turn first to Barbara Edinburgh, who's in the Bridgeport area where we did our focus groups earlier at the end of last year, and I think she can really update us on whether Bridgeport has looked a little more today like the video we just saw. So, Barbara, without further ado, open with some comments. Press the mic to start.
Thank you, and I'm honored to be on this panel and to bring the grassroots perspective. I'm here today representing Bridgeport, Connecticut's children, parents, and 80 community organizations that serve families in our area. Our organization is a coalition that advocates for child well-being through policy change. I live and work in what is commonly called the Gold Coast. Well, that Gold Coast is eroding. The recession is not just having a ripple effect where we live and it looks like elsewhere across the country. It feels more like a tidal wave to those of us on the ground. First the shock, then the aftershock, and then the long cleanup. Nonprofits like ours are facing a triple whammy. First, declining revenue streams for nonprofits forcing us to stretch our diminishing resources to the limit. Second, a state budget deficit in the billions of dollars resulting in drastic cuts in services, which puts more of a burden on nonprofits. And then third, increased community need, as you've seen in this most powerful video. As a nonprofit, we depend upon funding from private foundations, in fact, more than two-thirds of our budget. And in the current economy, our funders report declining endowments by as much as 30%, and donations from individual donors are down. So if this past year was bad, we anticipate the next year will be even worse. We've cut our budget to the bone. We have frozen a vacant position, and there's only six of us, so there's not much left. And last spring, we had staff furloughs. The only thing that's not declining is community need. Our mission, we feel, is more important than ever before. One of our initiatives is to provide outreach and help families apply for Medicaid and CHIP. And in so doing, we systematically address and identify barriers to enrollment. In June, Bridgeport's official unemployment rate was 11.9%. We just completed a survey of 2,000 families, and we found closer to 30% had been laid off, two out of three in the last 6 months. So you ask if our conditions in Bridgeport reflect what we've seen in the video, absolutely, and then some. And last year, we started to see not only increasing numbers of families who lost coverage, but also families representing all socioeconomic demographics. And we're not alone. many of our coalition members, our social service agencies, community health centers, hospitals, are all seeing more families without insurance, and families not only from the city, but from the surrounding suburbs as well. And many of those, as you've heard in the video, have never needed assistance before. They're overwhelmed. Many of the families were working low-wage jobs to begin with, and with no assets to fall back on, no bank account, they have no money squirreled away for a rainy day, and let me assure you, they don't get any severance packages. On the other hand, we are also seeing parents coming in who had been earning six-figure incomes. They might have gotten a severance package, but that's rapidly coming to an end. They've never been in this situation before. They don't know where to turn. They feel shame. They are humiliated. So our outreach efforts are more challenging. One-on-one outreach, we find, is critical, and it's very labor-intensive. We are debunking myths. We're reassuring parents that it's okay to apply for Medicaid. The state is not going to take their house. It's not going to seize their assets. And at the same time, we have to often give adults the bad news that they don't qualify. We find that sometimes their unemployment puts them over income. In one of the mom's cases in the focus group, we did death benefits. She was a young widow, put her over income. They are single, or they don't have children living at home, so they don't qualify for our Medicaid programs. And so with all of this, those of us in the helping professions are feeling very much in the middle. We're living with more stress, and we're at high risk of burnout and fear of losing our own jobs. And now add to the mix a state budget deficit in the billions of dollars, and there is debate going on even as I speak on how to bridge that gap. We don't have a state budget yet. Among the proposed cuts, no surprise, Medicaid. The federal stimulus funding through ARRA has given Connecticut and other states like ours a lifeline. Of the $3 billion that Connecticut is going to receive in federal stimulus dollars, $1.3 billion is going to be for Medicaid. But many of us, of the advocates, feel that as importantly as the increase in dollars are the requirements placed on states to access those funds. Our state is threatening to eliminate simplified application processes that have helped families get on Medicaid more quickly and access needed care sooner. Other budget-cutting proposals include requirements for premiums for low-income parents on Medicaid, shortening the renewal process, both of which would result in a loss of coverage. If enacted, these cuts will reduce health services for over 450,000 low-income children, families, seniors, and persons with disabilities who are now on Medicaid. So maintenance of effort requirements under the federal stimulus program has given us the leverage we need to maintain these critically needed services. But I have to say, if there are any positives coming out of the recession, it has helped us in Connecticut build public will for health care reform. We're finding the newly unemployed and uninsured are angry. They have worked all their lives, and overnight, they have lost it all. People who have never given health care a second thought are now faced with no coverage. So we have been able to turn that anger into a powerful voice for change. Along with other advocates across the state, we have mobilized tens of thousands of Connecticut residents and small business owners in the fight for health care reform. And as a result of this collective advocacy, Connecticut state legislators in Hartford, the insurance capital of the country, overturned the governor's veto and just passed landmark legislation that will put Connecticut on the direct path to affordable, comprehensive health care, including a public health plan alternative by July 2012. But we are not nearly out of the woods. Results from health care reform are more than 2 years away. So in the interim, state funds for outreach when we need it the most are gone. Eliminating Medicaid services for new legal immigrant parents, restricting adult Medicaid dental to emergency visits, increases in premiums for children on CHIP are but of the few programs that are still on the chopping block. I wish I could say that Bridgeport, Connecticut is unique, but we are not, and you have seen in this powerful video. So I want to thank the Kaiser Family Foundation for inviting me, but also for this most compelling video for helping shed a light on what parents are experiencing every day. We are seeing the repercussions of the recession day in and day out, and it is very grim out there. Thank you.
I'm an emergency physician. I practice in Atlanta in the only level one trauma center serving a metro area of 5 million people. I want to tell you a true story because it is important that we understand this is not about abstract concepts. The consequences of this recession and its impact on the healthcare system are affecting the lives of real people. It took them 2 hours to reach Atlanta from the North Georgia mountains. I faced them across the outstretched body of their son. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. The sound, the noise of the emergency department diminished as the nurse closed the heavy leaded doors to the trauma bay behind her so that I could have a private conversation with him. The ventilator hissed rhythmically, 10 breaths a minute. His chest tube bubbled constantly. He had an intracranial pressure monitor poking out of the young man's head. Mom and Dad were on one side of the bed. I was on the other. The father stared straight down at the floor. Mom looked deep into my eyes, searching for a sign. I spoke first. I said, "Your son was in a terrible crash. His truck left the road at high speed. The paramedics could see that he was critically injured, and they called a helicopter. That's why they brought him here. He arrived about 3 hours ago. He has several injuries, a collapsed lung, internal bleeding, but those aren't his most severe problem. His brain injury worries us the most." And that's when Mom interrupted. She said, and this is as best I recall a direct quote, "Doctor, I don't know how to say this, but I must. My husband lost his job 6 weeks ago. I work, but my employer doesn't offer health insurance. Is my son going to get the care he needs?" And then she started to cry. I was taken aback. But then I looked at her and I said, "Ma'am, you're at Grady Hospital, one of the finest trauma centers in the South. I promise you, we will do everything in our power to save your son." I meant what I said that night, but I didn't tell her the whole truth. She wasn't prepared to hear it, and I was in no shape to say it. I didn't tell her that our best might not be good enough, and that if her son survived, he'd probably be disabled for the rest of his life. I didn't tell her that although she and every American is entitled to emergency care without regard for their ability to pay, they would be billed for the helicopter flight, for the emergency department treatment, and for the days or weeks to come in the intensive care unit, and that that bill would likely be well over $100,000, maybe many hundreds of thousands of dollars. I didn't tell her that because the kind of people she and her husband are, they would do everything in their power to try to pay that bill. Mortgage their house, empty their savings, scrape all the money they could together, and it wouldn't be nearly enough. And the coins and the bills left in a coffee can at the local diner wouldn't come close to covering the difference. I didn't tell her that that unpaid balance of their son's bill would push Grady Memorial Hospital closer to insolvency, closer to its own crash. And if Grady were to close, Metro Atlanta, the economic engine of Georgia and a leading center for economic activity in the southeastern United States, would lose its only level one trauma center, its only burn unit, the state's only poison control center, the only comprehensive sickle cell center in the region, and 700 inpatient beds. And if you took Grady out of the mix, the private hospitals in the Metro Atlanta area would fall one after another like dominoes. This story illustrates the personal, the family, the community, and the national consequences of having tens of millions of Americans without health insurance. And we now, as you've already heard, have probably 5 million more since this recession started. And this problem is not limited to the inner city or to metro areas like Atlanta. It's nationwide. Back in January, when things were a little better than now, the American College of Emergency Physicians surveyed its members. 1,700 doctors responded. 3/4 of them said they regularly see patients who have, because they delayed or put off or ignored symptoms out of fear of the cost, have ended up in the emergency department with severe or life-threatening problems. Nearly 90% of the docs in that survey said that they'd seen patients who had been turned away from doctor's offices or from clinics because they were now uninsured. And that was in January. The situation is more grim today. In 2004, a committee I co-chaired for the Institute of Medicine systematically analyzed the data on the individual, the family, the community, and the national consequences of uninsurance. And we issued 6 reports that documented the enormous, enormous harm that this does to our great country. At the end of all that work, we came out with 2 recommendations, only 2, unusual for the IOM. One of them was that until we achieve universal coverage, that we should not dismantle SCHIP or Medicaid. But the central recommendation of that committee in 2004 was that the President and the Congress should commit themselves to an unequivocal goal of covering everyone in this country, providing them with health insurance, and achieving that goal by 2010. Well, by my watch, folks, we got about 4 months to go. We have got to get beyond the politics of nope and solve this problem in a sustainable, effective, and fair way so that no mother need ever ask again, will my son get the care he needs?
Thank you. Good morning. The findings of these reports and the stories that you've heard are really very consistent with what's going on in Colorado as well. Although we are much better off in many ways than other states and other communities in terms of our unemployment rate and our economy. We have, though, had the largest Medicaid enrollment in the history of Medicaid in Colorado, 14% growth last year, and we're expected this calendar year to see, again, double-digit growth in our enrollments. Without the stimulus money, without the ARRA funds, we would very likely have had to completely eliminate our children's health insurance program, over 65,000 children and pregnant women that we serve in that program. The other thing I think it's really important for people to know, and the report alludes to this a little bit, if I had shown you a PowerPoint, I have this great graph that my budget staff did that show the direct relationship between unemployment rates and then the rising enrollments in our public health insurance programs. But what's more telling about this graph is that it takes about a year after the economy turns around and employment begins to rise again. There's about a 9 to 12 month lag time before we start to see a leveling off or even a decrease in the need for an enrollment in these programs. So when we made budget cuts over the past 3 months to fill our $400 million budget gap in Colorado, we were instructed and had to carry those cuts through not just this particular fiscal year that just began a month ago, the 9-10 fiscal year, but those cuts have to carry over into 10-11 because of the expected but similar budget cuts in the 10-11 year. And frankly, we are looking at those as permanent cuts. So whatever we are giving up right now in our public insurance programs, whatever benefits, whatever special programs, and we don't have very many optional programs or benefits in Colorado, we are seeing those as permanent cuts. Now, not to make light of this conversation, but as I was coming here last night, you know, you get on the plane and you're trudging down the aisle toward the back of the plane and most of the seats are still empty. And I'm walking down the aisle and I'm walking down the aisle and it occurred to me, we are never going to get those pillows and blankets back again. You know, they're gone from the aircraft, and they're gone forever. There will be no reason in this economy for them to ever give us those little benefits back again. And that's how we're beginning to feel about our Medicaid programs and our public insurance programs. You know, we gave a lot up in the last recession in terms of optional programs and optional benefits and innovative ideas. And now we're doing that again. And this time, I just don't think we're going to get them back. So that's sort of the mood among states and Medicaid directors at this point. Colorado has some unique challenges, as do a few other states, around constitutional restrictions against raising additional revenues and taxing. We also have some restrictions around caps on spending. So this, for us, is very much a revenue problem.
as is true in most states, and we have some additional constraints against that. We also have this interesting little thing in Colorado, a constitutional amendment that guarantees K through 12 education spending. So when we took, that's 40% of our state general revenue, 40% of the budget, the expenditures, are off the table for reductions. So there are only three departments left in the state of Colorado where the bulk of the general fund goes. It's healthcare policy and financing for public health insurance, human services for all of the other social services that these same families and same communities use, and Department of Corrections. So we get the most money, we're going to take the most hit on general fund shortfalls. In spite of that, we've seen 90,000 new people enroll in our programs in the past 2 years, and we passed the largest health reform bill in the history in 40 years since Medicaid began, our Health Care Affordability Act. So through a provider fee, we don't call them taxes in Colorado, but through a provider fee assessment, we will raise another $1 billion, and we will cover another 100,000 uninsured people in Colorado. And that's fabulous. That'll make a huge dent in the need that we have, but we still have 800,000 people without coverage. We have administrative challenges. It's important to remember that almost every state still uses big, old, clunky legacy systems to do all of the payments and eligibility and enrollment. These are not nimble systems that can accommodate these huge caseload growths and claims growths that we're paying out. So those are challenging. We have lots of new requirements around program integrity and contract management enrollment. You know, states, you hear people often say, well, Medicaid is such an efficient program, you know, administrative costs are below 5%. Our admin costs, we have about a $4 billion Medicaid program, and our admin expenditures are about 3.3%. I do not brag about that. That is not enough money and not enough effort to be managing such a huge program when you're trying to do all of the oversight and the quality and the auditing and the program integrity that we are expected to provide, not just by our federal partners, but by our state auditors. So it's great to say that's efficient, but there are things that don't get done that should be getting done when you're running such a huge healthcare enterprise that we can't do because of these financial constraints. So our focus, like most states, has really been on efficiencies and trying to drive down per capita costs and bring as much efficiency to our programs as we possibly can without sacrificing the quality of care that the most vulnerable populations need. And frankly, we're not going to do this on the backs of our providers. We think that's the wrong way to go. We have had to cut some provider rates, but we've done it in a very targeted way. We've done it in collaboration with our providers. We went to the provider communities and we said, look, you know the budget reality. You know what we're faced with. You serve our clients every day. You see waste. You see things you could do better. So you come to us and tell us what you could do around utilization and better management of the benefits. And if you come up with some good ideas, we'll score those. We'll put them forward toward our budget cuts. And we'll spare you a 2% or a 3% or a 4% cut. So the providers who came up with great ideas that saved us money were spared cuts. Those who didn't took 2 and 3 and 4% cuts. So that's how we want to continue working with our provider community. But I do fear that as the economic situation worsens, we won't have quite that flexibility. So I'll just close by sharing some of Art's thoughts here. You know, it's just sort of a funny comment coming from a state official, but we absolutely need some national solutions. We need national framework. We need national policies, national standards. And you can do all that. I absolutely believe you can do that without sacrificing the need for state and, frankly, local customization of how you actually deliver services. But states can do a lot, and we are doing a lot, but we cannot continue to do this without major national reform. Thank you.
Thank you. It's hard to follow such a gripping set of presentations, frankly. So I'm here as the Fed, who's here to help, huh? This has been, I think, a very moving set of presentations, and mostly we've been focusing, as we should, about challenges and hardships. But it's important, I think, to step back and appreciate, in the midst of this hardship and the difficulties created, particularly by the recession, of Medicaid's invaluable role in maintaining coverage and, in fact, filling in so many of the gaps created by the hardships that people are facing. If you think about it, Medicaid is the only source of insurance that continues, and in fact, naturally, sort of by its nature, expands when all other sources of coverage are contracting. And it really underscores the vital role that Medicaid plays daily, and particularly in downturns. That having been said, of course, the presentations today underscore some of the very difficult challenges that families, providers, states, communities are facing. So let me review a little bit of some of those challenges as we've been seeing it across the nation from the federal level. First of all, of course, running the Medicaid program is the fundamental mission is to ensure that all eligible people get the coverage to which they are entitled and that coverage is quality care. Lots of new individuals are now eligible for Medicaid, but as the presentations demonstrate, many of them are new to the system. Many of them have not been receiving Medicaid coverage before, are unfamiliar with the fact that they may be eligible or that their children may be eligible, or unfamiliar with the methods of applying, or have notions in their head that they can't be eligible if they have a home or if they have a car. So one of the things that you really need to do in these times is to do some new kinds of outreach, to go to unemployment offices, to go to employers, to go to different places to be able to reach out to families and let them know about the eligibility and the simplified ways that most states now allow people to apply for Medicaid. But, of course, in a downturn, that's exactly not the time when we have those resources available. We have some struggling community organizations doing that, but for the most part, states aren't doing that. They aren't in the position of putting outreach dollars on the table, and some of them are actively hoping that outreach doesn't happen because it means additional enrollment, which is additional fiscal pressure on the states. So that's one of the challenges, is how do we make sure we reach all these newly eligible people and get them enrolled? In addition to not even having outreach dollars, we know from states around the country that they're facing significant administrative cutbacks. So we're seeing cutbacks in staffing all around the country and real concerns about timeliness of processing applications and redeterminations. So we need to make sure that infrastructure is there to support the eligibility that is available for people. We need to support that in the community. We need to support that at the state and the local level. And I think many people can be part of that solution. States are obviously a part of that, but there's really many actors, I think, that can jump in. We have a long history of pulling together and doing some of this work for kids' outreach and enrollment, and we can really think about what are the new opportunities and new challenges of doing it during a time of recession. Beyond the enrollment, we have clearly seeing some issues around access, as some states are moving to lower their rates of payment to providers, in some cases rates that have already been threatening access to care. So that's an area that I know states are concerned about, providers are concerned about, and certainly we at the federal level are concerned about. We've seen some of the less benefit restrictions being adopted, but as Joan identified, those are areas that some states are going to be forced to continue considering. The ARRA funding, of course, has been an essential ingredient of the positive part of this success story, the positive part of Medicaid being that critical countercyclical health insurance program. As Robin's report identifies, there's been an 11.7% decline in state revenues in the budget period of March through June, and that's only getting worse. So what ARRA did is recognize that you have, in a time of recession, this wonderful role of Medicaid as being the countercyclical program that is there to expand coverage, but at the same time that states' budgets are in most difficult circumstances and their revenues are down. And so ARRA recognizes that reality by pumping a significant amount of new federal dollars into the Medicaid program through an increase in the federal share of Medicaid costs. Is estimated to be about $87 billion over nine quarters that end in December 2010. There's a number of provisions around ARRA. One is the direct increase in the FMAP. There's also an assurance that no state loses, has their FMAP decline during this period. The across-the-board increase is 6.25%, and then states get an extra bump up if they have higher unemployment rates, and there's that bump up is tiered based on the level of their increase in unemployment rates. There's 38 states right now that are getting that extra bump up because of the increase in the unemployment, and we expect that to grow. Along with the funding, as we've heard, there was a commitment written into the law that states that accept the increase in federal matching payments not roll back their eligibility levels and not make other changes in their program that would significantly reduce eligibility and enrollment. So that has meant, in fact, that a lot of states have either rolled back some changes that they took after July 1, 2008. They had until July 1, 2009 to change their procedures so that their procedures and their eligibility levels were at least where they had been in July 1, 2008. Some states were considering taking further steps in the legislature this past session and were they decided to stop taking those steps around eligibility changes because of the ARRA maintenance of effort provisions. And some states that are that would otherwise have put some of those changes on the table have refrained from doing that. We've spent a lot of time over the last several months working with states, working with state legislators, working with governors, and other organizations on working through those maintenance of effort provisions. It's meant that in some cases states have not increased premiums, that they have not adopted more stringent levels of care determination, not reduced the waiver slots that would have been available for people in home and community-based services, or increase the number of redeterminations that would have occurred, or made other changes that we know, thanks to so much of the work that the Kaiser Commission has done and others, that we know has a direct impact on reducing eligibility and enrollment. Those have been very important parts of keeping that critical countercyclical role of Medicaid together. We have heard, as we've heard today, from governors, from Medicaid directors, from legislators, from providers, and certainly from others in community organizations, that the funding and the provisions in ARRA have really been critical. The provision in the Recovery Act that gave the states that money was really one of the first set of dollars that was on the streets into state coffers. It provided an enormous stimulus value in terms of being available quickly and unfettered. It was truly shovel-ready. Even before the shovel was already ready before the dollars were there. And, of course, it played a critical role in maintaining coverage. I want to also note the enactment of CHIPRA as another source of additional federal dollars to support health care coverage during this time. In this case, particularly, of course, for kids and pregnant women, CHIPRA, the new dollars for the reauthorization of the Children's Health Insurance Program doesn't do what ARRA did. It doesn't reduce the state share of the cost going forward in terms of covering kids or in some instances also covering pregnant women. But it does provide stable and predictable and much more ample federal dollars for state coverage initiatives. And it's hard to remember, but, you know, with all the things that are going on now, but think back a year or so ago when we were faced with threats to coverage for children because states could not be assured that the federal funding was going to be there in a predictable way. We had some states, Georgia, for example, on the brink of closing down enrollment because they didn't have a guarantee of adequate, predictable federal funding. So CHIPRA has allowed states to at least move forward and keep their programs intact without worrying that at the end of the fiscal year or two-thirds down the way of the fiscal year, they may, in fact, run out of federal dollars and then be stuck with that coverage with state-only dollars in a time when they can't afford those state-only funds. So the value of that stable and more adequate funding, I think, shouldn't be overlooked in terms of the network of coverage that we do have in place, shattered though it is in many other regards. There's also an often forgotten provision in CHIPRA that it provides a performance bonus, or so it was described, but it may have other functions as we move forward. It recognized that states that increase their enrollment of CHIP kids and get the enhanced match that CHIP generally provides often have increased cost in the Medicaid program. And so CHIPRA provided some additional federal dollars to states for their Medicaid enrollment should they succeed in bringing their Medicaid enrollment of kids above certain pretty ambitious enrollment levels, given the recession as well as a lot of states continuing to move forward, like Colorado, with improvements in children's coverage. We anticipate that a fair number of states will actually benefit from that performance bonus and get some additional help on the Medicaid side for their kids. So while all these measures are, of course, incredibly important, I think it's the lesson, and I think the striking message from the presentations today is that what's really important is that we move ahead with health reform. We need, clearly, a recession-proof coverage system for everybody. ARRA did a lot of good things, but it didn't create Medicaid eligibility for some of the parents and the childless adults who simply are not eligible for state Medicaid programs. And, of course, it didn't help the small business owner who had to cut back on his health insurance that we saw in the video and his worker who with breast cancer who now has no way of affording care. While the recession is pushing forward new interest in cost containment measures, and I think a lot of interesting discussion is going on at the federal level and certainly at the state level around different ways to think about getting more value for our dollars, I think what is extraordinarily clear is that unless and until, and Dr. Kellerman probably said this most pointedly, unless and until we have everybody covered, we really cannot be efficient about doing our cost containment. So it is both obviously an enormously a compelling reason to go forward morally, but also for all of the reasons in terms of making this system a system that actually works. It appears that in all the proposals before us on health reform, Medicaid is a critical piece of the puzzle moving forward, and we're anxious to see how it'll all turn out and hope we will, in fact, get a bill by that four-month deadline. We certainly look forward to working with everybody here, the researcher community, the states, and the provider and community groups to making sure it really is the best system it can be as we go forward. Thank you.
Thank you. I think our panelists have clearly given us the additional 360 view of what is going on the ground, the importance of health reform, and how all of these issues hang together, the immediacy of the needs that people are facing today, the importance of ERA and of the Medicaid program, and that these programs are actually working to try and help people, but the challenges exceed some of the capacity that's out there. And I think looming for many is the fact that the ERA funds will themselves run out in 2011. So beyond that, how far will we be out of the recession, and how long will the lag be before the states and the Medicaid program catch up? And when will health reform, if and when enacted, kick in to provide assistance? So there's never anything easy about health care, either health care reform or health care as it's delivered today. But you've been very patient in hearing our gritty and grim tale of what is going on today. But I think there's always a lot of hope that we will use this as a way of understanding how to better provide the health care that Americans need. And with that, we're going to open the program up to your patient audience participation. So if you would identify yourself when you ask a question, raise your hand, we'll get a mic to you, and then just tell the panel who you are so that we know who's posing the question.
Thank you.
Hi, good morning. Linda Bregovsky from the Veterans Health Administration. One of the things that we always ask when we're talking to veterans is what other coverage do you have? And just curious how you in the field see VA as the other public funding. We hear a lot about Medicaid. We hear a lot about Medicaid coverage, but VA and Veterans Health Administration services in particular may be one service that could be open to childless adults who have served in the military and particularly who are challenged financially. So I would like to get some insight from those of you out in the field what the perspective is about VA as a gap-filling service.
Let's start with Joan.
Thank you. We don't see it as a gap-filling service. We see it as a critical part of our healthcare system in Colorado. And, of course, we're a large military state, and we have many, many folks coming back from the wars and going back into their communities, and it's putting quite a strain on the safety net system and the provider networks. We just entered into what we're hoping will be a long-term and excellent relationship with our VA healthcare system in Colorado. They actually came to us and said, you know, we think that there are a lot of veterans that you're serving in the Medicaid program that really should be coming to us first. We should be their primary medical home and first place to come. And we think we could actually save you, Medicaid, some money if we did a better job to coordinate these benefits. So we actually, one of our budget saving ideas in our 9-10 budget is to do better data matching and better coordination with the VA so that they go there first, and then we'll wrap around those services if they need us to. So we came at it from a little bit different perspective, but we see the VA services and the system as instrumental in helping us make sure everybody has access.
And Barbara, can you comment on the role you see?
Well, I made a note to make sure that we do ask that when we come across adults. Our VA system is about three towns over, so it's a good hour. And many of the parents that we've been seeing don't have transportation. So for them to get to the VA system is going to be particularly challenging. But I made a note to make sure that that's one of the issues that we start to look into to see how we can bridge that gap and make that system work more smoothly, because I don't think we're probably asking that. Thank you.
Here.
Do you want to go?
You can go ahead. Okay. I'll follow.
Is this on?
Hi,
Dan Henderson. I'm from the American Medical Student Association, and Barbara, I'm actually from Connecticut. I've worked in a lot of the towns you were mentioning there. So Medicaid and Medicaid patients tend to be the ones, as we saw, most affected by this problem. And I was just wondering if you could comment on how the Medicaid system, which already, you know, does a lot of rationing because the providers who take Medicaid are few and frankly very generous, are there signs that Medicaid is going to stop really offering coverage in response to these huge growth in the people on it? Or by coverage, really what I mean is access, in that, you know, if there's one doctor in a town who will take Medicaid and 1,000 more patients, you've got a problem.
That's why we need national health reform, so that that doesn't happen, for sure. What we're seeing, at least in Connecticut, that I've come across when we're looking at cuts are barriers to enrollment. I think because of maintenance of effort, our hope is that we won't cut back on our simplification processes. We have few physicians now that take Medicaid, very few. In fact, if you have a need for a specialist, if you need a neurologist and you live in Bridgeport, you need to go to Yale New Haven Hospital in New Haven, which is a good hour to 2 hours if you don't have transportation, and you're lucky if you can see someone within 3 months. It is really quite scary for parents. So I think we're going to start to see more roadblocks. Connecticut just changed about a year ago its health plans that were participating in the Medicaid program. So that added a further roadblock because we have even fewer physicians now accepting that. So our role, in addition to working with parents, is really to do outreach with the medical community, to try to encourage them to participate while we are trying to reduce some of the administrative hassles, frankly, that the state puts on even the providers who want to participate. I have a friend who is a doctor, and he said they came at me with a 20-page application. He said, I can't do it. So I just see people for free. So, you know, your question is you know, certainly a good one, and one we struggle with is how to ensure that we have access to care. And so I think we have to approach it while we're working on national health reform is to go out to the medical community and to talk to them about participating. And at the same time, we're looking at hopefully increasing reimbursement rates and reducing the administrative hassles. I don't know if that answered your questions, but
I think Art has a comment, and then Cindy, I'm sure, has a comment.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, really emphasize, we're seeing a lot of people now that are coming to public hospitals like Grady that had not previously been our clientele. And my doctor just said they can't take care of me anymore, or I lost my coverage, or I can't pay the copay every time I come in. And then the other area that hasn't come up, and I just want to get it out there, is local government is getting hit hard too. And counties are a critical part of preserving the safety net, particularly in larger communities. Grady Memorial is just a mirror of what we see across the country. Grady is supported by two county governments and largely by the state of Georgia through Medicaid and various other programs like our Indigent Care Trust Fund, our DISH program. But the surrounding suburban counties have never supported Grady and aren't going to now, although we're seeing more and more of their citizens. And the two core counties have progressively restricted their funding. Last spring, Fulton County government eliminated all public funding for Grady's ambulance service, which is the 911 responder for the entire city of Atlanta, and basically dared the hospital to shut down 911 ambulance service to the city. The hospital didn't do it. It has preserved that service, but it's running a deficit of over $30 million this year. The state of Georgia has reminded them that they kind of got an advance a few years back on Medicaid, and they owe Georgia $20 million in cash, which it doesn't have. And so it just keeps running up the deficit that it owes Emory Medical School and Morehouse Medical School as the lenders of last resort. So it's a very, very precarious situation. And I can assure you that's being mirrored in Chicago and Los Angeles and in large cities across the country, and in many respects even tougher in smaller communities that don't have the economic backing. So it is a very dicey situation. We don't have a margin of error here. I'm telling everybody this time around, don't think about Harry and Louise. Think about Thelma and Louise. We have to change the direction. If we keep going straight ahead, a nation of 300 million people is going over the cliff.
Oh, Cindy, would you like to respond?
I'm not going to go after Art anymore. Well, I just want to say something about the comment on Medicaid rationing. You know, I'm struck first by the fact that my insurance, my doctors don't take my insurance, my private insurance. So we're seeing problems all throughout the system. I mean, I can decide to front the money for my primary care and take the risk that someday the insurance company will pay me back. But lots of people who work for my employer can't. We've got problems all across the board in terms of how our system works and what rationing looks like for different people. And it's not just an issue in the Medicaid program. There clearly are some issues around Medicaid rates and access, particularly for certain specialties and in certain parts of the country. Just wanted to remind people that in the CHIPRA legislation, there was a new commission that was developed and that the GAO is putting together that's specifically looking at the question of access and the question of rates. It's an area we're certainly going to be looking at and are looking at more closely as we go forward. So it's very much on the table and with respect to the health reform bills, but there's activity going on now. And before we have health reform implemented, I think to look carefully at this and to see what we can do.
And the pink.
I'm Peggy Eastman with Oncology Times newspaper, and I have a question related to health reform because virtually all of you have said that's really going to be the answer. So from what you've seen so far with the House bill, we don't yet have a Senate bill, but from what you've seen so far, and particularly with the discussion about a public option, are you all confident that we will, in fact, have something that passes and goes to the president's desk by the end of this year? And do you think that that will really help, as you have suggested, this is the only way to go? Do you think that will really solve some of these problems that you've mentioned today?
Cindy?
Yes. I heard a quote from a physician. In fact, it was an oncologist just 2 days ago. And he said, well, anybody can predict the future, just don't be dumb enough to put a date on it. And he actually, he used the word stupid, but I wouldn't dare do that in this town these days. But we absolutely do need some help. And yes, I do think we are going to see some reforms. The Medicaid portion of it, you know, the bill that I mentioned, the Healthcare Affordability Act for Colorado, takes basically does what the national proposal is. Doesn't go quite as far, but it will take our Medicaid population to 100% of the federal poverty level for parents and for childless adults. So we obviously very much support that policy. There's just no question in our minds. Now, people who are poor in Colorado do not all look the same as people who are poor in California or people who are poor in Connecticut. There are some differences based on your workforce and economy. But we know that in Colorado, for families living with that level of income, they just are never going to be able to buy their own insurance. And they're not likely to have jobs, the kind of employment mix that we have in Colorado. They're not likely to have a job that will offer insurance or a job where they can afford their portion of the premium. So we believe very strongly that government has to help them. And so that's a policy that's very consistent where we were going toward anyway. So we're optimistic at least about that portion of the bill. We are not frightened by this public plan notion. Although we haven't seen a lot of detail on it, you know, we think there are a number of ways you can look at that. You could look at state employee plan as something you could buy into. You could look at Medicaid. You could look at your safety net plan. Most states have very good safety net insurance plans where the traditional safety net providers and FQHCs are a big part of that provider network. So we're not afraid of that as an option in our marketplace.
And I think, if anything, this panel has showed that the status quo is not exactly a good option for the future. We have a question in the back.
Good morning. My name is Claudine Swartz. I'm with the National Association of Public Hospitals. So I'm so glad that Kaiser is paying special attention to this issue, and I'm glad that Dr. Kellerman, a longtime friend of our organization, was able to be here today and give thoughtful remarks. I'm wondering if the panel could reflect on the ongoing role of the safety net post-reform. In keeping with the earlier gentleman's questions, I'm concerned that some folks may view that national health reform would obviate the need for a strong safety net. So if you could reflect on what appropriate investments may be made in the health reform legislation to ensure a viable safety net, I'd greatly appreciate it.
Cindy?
Looking at me, I'm just a doctor. Oh,
I was going to Cindy go before Art.
No, you're not following me.
Well, it's important question and demands a multifaceted answer, I think. There's no question in my mind that the safety net needs to be not only continued but strengthened in health reform. There's a lot of roles that this so-called safety net plays, and people have different definitions of what that safety net is. In some communities, it is the source of insurance for people who have no other insurance. In the world of health reform, we'd like to think that everybody will have insurance, but as you can look at some of the legislation, you realize that not everybody will have insurance. even under the strongest versions of the legislation that we've seen emerge from Congress, and particularly people who are new to the country, and hopefully there'll be less administrative barriers for people, but people also just getting through all the hoops. But not everybody's going to be eligible, I think, under anybody's design. But beyond that, as we know, that safety net hospitals and community health centers are also often critical places that do business in communities where other providers aren't doing business, and they provide those services in a very mission-oriented way, with a very close connection and understanding of the communities that they serve. And that's not going to go away in any system. What we hope is, under a new system, that those facilities will have adequate support and financing and a seat at the table.
One angle that I don't think we've adequately thought about is how important safety net hospitals are to preparedness and to homeland security and to national security in disasters, in a potential terrorist attack, and just in the large scale and day-to-day life-threatening emergencies that happen at a community level as level one trauma centers, as burn units, and as disaster resource hospitals. A few months ago, Mike Spivey and I wrote a perspective piece in the New England Journal of Medicine about this, and I would commend it to your attention, and suggested that some fairly straightforward modifications of the current statute regarding DISH might be a vehicle, even as DISH perhaps goes down in a post-reform era. I think having targeted dollars for preparedness will be very important for the country. I co-chaired a roundtable for the Institute of Medicine a couple of months ago on emergency and disaster care, and a very thoughtful federal official said, by law, we pay for the delivery of care. We aren't allowed to pay for preparedness. I think everyone in this room wants to know that if the bad one happens, or if there's a disaster in the District of Columbia or in a major community in this country, that the system will be ready and able to respond. That requires preparedness investments. That also keeps the safety net strong and functioning.
If I can just add from the community, just to follow up, the safety net services, at least in our community, the federally qualified health centers, FQHCs, and the hospitals play a critical role. For many families in the inner city, they are their primary source of care, and that's not going to change. And so if anything, they need to be strengthened. We're not going to get private doctor, private pediatric, or internal practices in the inner city. So let's hope that that's strengthened. And just to follow up on the question about a public health plan alternative, as an advocate, I would say we better have something. Thanks.
We have one question here.
Hello, my name is John Kane. I'm with the National Coalition on Healthcare, and I actually grew up in Bethpage, Long Island, which is one town over from Levittown, so that was somewhat chilling to see that in the video. My question is about the more I speak with individuals, I find that there's a certain amount of contempt for government programs. You know, we've all heard the statement, that's ironic as it is, to keep the government out of my Medicare. And I find that particularly with Medicaid, there's a particular amount of shame that's felt, as you pointed out, Ms. Edenberg. I was wondering if you can comment on how to get people past that amount of contempt or shame that they feel and the stigma that's attached to public programs, and to try and get people to understand that enrollment in a public program is not somehow a detriment to themselves or a detriment to who they are as people.
For us, a lot of it is that one-on-one outreach, and it's establishing a trusting relationship with the family that we're working with, and to say that Medicaid is available for them as their health insurance plan. What is difficult is many do have to then change their doctors. And so until we have national health care reform and universal coverage so that everyone goes to it doesn't matter. I remember, and it's quite chilling, a parent said to me, I wish it didn't matter when I went to the doctor, this is a mom on Medicaid, the color of my skin, the language that I spoke, or the card that I carry. And so until we get to that point where it doesn't matter what card you carry, it's still going to have that stigma. And so it falls upon us in the community to reassure parents that it is okay, that it's not shameful, that this is something that they are entitled to, they're eligible for it, they're entitled to it, it is their right to have health care. And so I think we all can do a better job at really trying to assure parents that it is okay, and it's just going to take a long time, and that trust.
Joan?
I think that's a really important question, because you heard Cindy use the words Medicaid as a counter-cyclical program, and we say those words all the time at the state level. But the discussion we're having now at the national level really changes that. We're saying that families and people who are earning a certain amount of income, we will become their insurance plan. And I think we have to think of that very differently then. It means that this is going to be the way you get your insurance. And very few states have Medicaid doctors, Medicaid clinics. This has always been a public-private partnership. Yes, you know, we have a $4 billion healthcare enterprise with 275 employees. You find another insurance plan in the country that has that much money and runs programs with so few people. We have to rely on the private sector, the health plans, the healthcare systems, the docs, the hospitals, the clinics. It's always been that way, and I think we just have to start using different language and think about it very differently as an insurance program for people. It's the floor. It's where we start. And even the safety net providers, the FQHCs, you know, people have, there are a lot of myths about them. And believe me, at least in Colorado, we have a very robust clinic system. Some of the best health care you could get in Colorado takes place in a federally qualified health center. You know, this notion that they are just for poor people or just for immigrants, when that's where you can get some of the best health care, including chronic care management, that you could find anywhere in the state.
Robin?
I'll just echo Barbara's comments about doing specific outreach. And I think we found in New York and on Long Island and other communities as well that had dedicated enrollment assisters to help people through the application process and work with the state eligibility offices. Those were invaluable assistance. And there are other communities doing outreach specifically in the clinics and the emergency departments. So as people are coming in for care, letting them know what their options are in terms of coverage are valuable as well.
And I think it's also been true when people are uninsured, they tend to value coverage regardless of where it comes from. And I think that's one of the issues that we really need to build on. Parents in surveys that we've done that have uninsured children have gladly wanted to enroll them and just want to know how to do it and how to get them more quickly enrolled in Medicaid and CHIP. So it's insurance matters for families, and I think that's what we're seeing here. We've kind of come to the close, but I know there's one more question over here, and then we're going to have to wrap up.
Hi. My name is Adam Doherty. I represent Insure the Uninsured Project out of Los Angeles. We look for dynamic ways to expand health insurance to the 7 million uninsured Californians. And as you know, California is facing a significant budget crisis right now. Though the budget balanced, our governor has line item vetoed a number of health services. So my question is in regard to the health reform proposals currently on the table. We're seeing Medicaid proposed to expand to 133%, even 150% of the federal poverty level. And of course, Medicaid reimbursement rates being increased eventually to Medicare levels. So I was wondering what the panel thought about how and if states would be supportive of such an effort if they had to contribute financially to this, and how we could do this without basically seeing a state-level revolt from a number of states. So that's my question.
It's a pretty compelling final question.
Well, we meaning Colorado, are very supportive of the national proposals. We think we need a national solution, and we think that the president's principles are on the right track. I don't believe that, based on conversations and that I've listened in on and been part of, I don't believe the governors per se have come to consensus among themselves about what exactly they feel they can handle and can't handle. States are always concerned about unfunded mandates and the pressure. And you've heard from states, from communities, from counties that expecting us to continue with these cyclical things and the unique budget constraints that we have, the fact that we have to balance our budgets within 12-month periods every year, we just can't keep doing this by ourselves. As good as we are doing and as hard as everybody's working and as many people as we're serving, we have to have some national solutions.
Yeah, and I would just add, I think our experience is very similar. We've been working with the governors and speaking with them regularly on it, and clearly governors, and this is the time to make it most emphatic, is don't want to sustain new obligations that they can't afford. That having been said, I think there's a broad agreement and certainly NGA policy to support health care reform, and there's a lot of aspects of the legislation that can bring some very significant relief to states and to state budgets and obviously to state residents if you look broadly across the legislation, in addition to, you know, some of the actually fairly generous provisions around the Medicaid financing that's in the House bill. So I think looking at the bill as a whole is what a lot of states are doing and what they need to do going forward. If not now, when? And if there's no solution now, what will the situation be like for states going forward as well as for people?
I hope that everybody, as you leave today, that you don't leave depressed. I hope you leave determined. This is crunch time. This month and the next few months in terms of what's going to happen, if we're going to have any major action on a federal level. And I would appeal as we go forward that we seek balance, because I think what a theme today is how out of balance the current system is in this country and what a price people pay. Ambulances and emergency departments are about 2% of our country's health care spending. We're staffed by about 4% of America's doctors. We provide over half of all the acute care visits by the uninsured in the United States, more than the other 96% of doctors combined. That's not balance. The Congress is struggling right now with health reform legislation, and they're trying to find as many dollars as they can to cover Americans. That is a good thing. But my colleagues and I, the providers, who all say we need to control costs, are all for cost control, provided it's not my costs. My piece of the $2.3 trillion a year we're spending on health care, that won't work. That dog won't hunt. We have got to find realistic savings, and they're out there, in fraud, in waste, abuse, and inefficiency. But no part of the health care industry, pharma, hospitals, physicians, medical technology, thinks they're part of that savings piece. That's got to change. We have to have a balance of cost reductions in the right places and fair and proper coverage for every American. It is within our grasp if we don't fall apart and turn on each other. And so I hope in the next few months we'll see the greatness of America, which is when we pull together to do something good and right and not become petty and self-serving once again. And that drama will play out. So let's leave more determined than ever to make this work.
No, Art just used crunch time, and I thought that this was worse than a crunch. It was a crisis, so we took the word crunch out of our – we were headed for a crunch in our last round on the recession, and this time we thought that it was really much more dire, and the needs are much more immediate. And I hope that we have not left you too depressed, but determined, as Art said, to at least try and provide some immediate help now for the families that are struggling, but also – to be sure that in health reform we preserve the base on which so much coverage has been built and be able to move forward to get better coverage for everyone. I want to thank all of the panelists as well as the staff that worked on the video and the reports for helping to bring all these issues together today, and I hope it's been a useful and informational session for you all. Thank you very much.